of the bloody manor. And they all look at me, eyes widening in amazement, and then they start giggling again. Can't help it. Giggling at the silly lady who's come in and tried to stop the fun, as though you could turn fun off just like that. Sometimes I think Paul is too close to them. It's not healthy. Mostly, I'd do anything for her to stay. A teacher at Emily's school told me she's known mothers who sack the childminder every 6 months so the children don't get too attached. I mean, how selfish can you get? Denying them a familiar, loving presence just because you want it to be you, and it can't be you. Of course, I sometimes find myself worrying that she doesn't talk to the children as I would talk to them. When I was a kid, I used to say dinner for lunch and tea for dinner, but now I've joined the professional classes, I teach my kids lunch and dinner, and then Paula comes along and teaches them dinner and tea. I can't complain, can I? Richard corrects them. Lou, he says firmly, as Emily demands once again to go to the toilet. But to be honest, I feel more comfortable with the common words myself. I know Paula lets them watch quite a bit of TV, but in other ways I can see she's much better than I would be. Consistent, more patient. After a weekend with them, I'm screaming to be let out of the house, but with Paula it's steady as she goes. Never raises her voice. A lot that's good in their characters comes from her. When I went into school for a meeting with the teacher the other night, the headmistress took me aside and said that if Emily was going to have any hope of getting into Piper Place, she would need, how to put this, more of the right kind of stimulation at home. Children with mothers who didn't go out to work were being taken on regular visits to museums. They had a broader perspective. Even if they ate alphabetti spaghetti, it was always in sodding Latin. Whereas homes with both parents out at work, well, there can be a tendency to rely on the television, said Miss Ackland, getting five syllables out of the dreaded word. Emily, she said, seems to have a quite remarkable knowledge of Walt Disney videos. This was her way of telling me Paula wasn't good enough. Emily, continued Miss Ackland, we'll need to show a wide range of interests to secure a place at a good secondary school. Competition in London is very fierce, as you know, Mrs. Shattuck. I suggest an instrument, not the violin, too common now, perhaps the clarinet, which has plenty of personality, and you could consider one of the more unusual sports. Rugby for girls, she believed, was gaining in popularity. Emily needs a CV at the age of 6? Maybe I should have tried to keep the incredulity out of my voice. Well, Mrs. Shattuck, in certain home situations where neither parent is present, these kinds of things can, shall we say, slip. Did you learn an instrument yourself as a child? No, but my father sang a lot to us. Oh, she said, the kind of oh that kind of woman holds in a pooper scooper. Hideous, money-grubbing education witch. In her last job, the one before us, Paula worked for a family in Hampstead. Julia, the mother, said the kids weren't allowed to watch TV. And Julia worked in telly, making all this crap for Channel 5, Paula told me one day, laughing loudly at the memory. And it's like her kids weren't allowed telly because it's evil. At the weekends, Julia and her husband Mike stayed in bed while the kids were downstairs watching videos. Paula found this out because Adam, the youngest, told her one Monday when she caused a row by trying to switch the TV off. When I think of that story, I can feel myself redden. Aren't I guilty of the same double standard? I tell Paula that Ben must have water, not juice, and then, at the weekend, if he asks me for apple juice, I give in quickly to buy myself some peace and quiet. And because I see him so little, I want our times together to be happy. So I want my nanny to be a better mother than I would ever be. I expect her to love my two like they're her own, and then, when I come home and find her loving them like her own, they're suddenly my children and to be loved by nobody except me. As I unload the dishwasher and start to wash by hand all the plates that aren't properly clean, I can see Paula looking at me from the other end of the kitchen. She's brushing Emily's hair and really looking at me. I wish I knew what she thought. She said to me once that she would never have a nanny if she had kids of her own. She knew too much about what went on. The girls who suck up to the mums and then, as soon as they're out the door, it's on the mobile calling their mates. Emily lets out a cry as the brush snags on a tangle.
Hush now, Paula chides. Princesses have to have their hair brushed 100 times every night, don't they, Mummy?
She looks across the room, seeking an act of conciliation and consent. No, I don't want to know. If I knew what she really thought, it would probably kill me. Still, a part of me wishes I knew what she thought. Part 4 Chapter 29 The Supermarket Shop. Emily's birthday always means the start of summer for me. When my waters broke 6 years ago and I took a cab to the hospital, there were people sitting at cafe tables on the pavements and spilling into the street, and it felt as though the whole city was in carnival for the arrival of my child. The day before her party, I do the supermarket shop with Ben. Do the supermarket shop. Who could imagine that such a small sentence could contain so much pain? An oresteia of suffering. First off, I try to liberate one of the extra-wide trolleys, which is in coitus with the trolley outside the store. I pull and push with one hand, holding on to runaway toddler with the other. An aviary on wheels, the extra-wide trolley is roughly as maneuverable as the Isle of Wight. I try to persuade Ben to sit in the baby seat. He declines, preferring to ride in the cargo hold where he can eject any purchase he disapproves of. In desperation, I crack open a box of mini-milks and give him 2. While both his hands are full of lolly, I slip him into the seat and snap the clips. Bad, bad bribing mother. Now all that remains is to track down the 37 items on my list. After I threw the radio at him this morning, Richard said he thought the whole birthday thing was perhaps stressing me out a little. Why didn't I take a break, and he'd do the supermarket shop? Impossible, I said. He would buy all the wrong things. But there's a list, Kate, he reasoned, in his man-in-a-white-coat voice. How could I possibly go wrong? What every woman knows, and no man can ever grasp, is that even if he brings home everything on the list, he will still not have got the right things. Why? Because the woman truly believes that if she had gone to the supermarket, she would have made better choices. A plumper chicken from a more luxuriantly pastured region of France, a yummier yogurt, the exact salad leaf she has yearned for and whose precise name had, until the epiphany in front of the healthy eating cabinet, eluded her. Men make lists to order the world, to tie it down. For women, lists are the start of something, the coordinates by which we plot our journey to freedom. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not claiming that any of this is fair. When a woman buys an item not on the list, which turns out to be inedible, this is called an experiment. When a man does the same thing, it is a waste of money. 3:31 p.m. Join the checkout queue. I'm sure I have forgotten something vital. What? 3:39 p.m. Oh, great. Ben has a dirty nappy. As I'm wondering how long I can hang in here and defy the astounded nostrils of nearby customers, my son puts his hand, the one holding what's left of the second mini-milk, down his shorts. When he withdraws the hand, it is marbled with ice cream and excrement. I want to faint with misery. Instead, holding the boy aloft like a grenade with the pin-out, I sprint the length of the store to the baby-changing facility. 4:01 p.m. Rejoin queue. 16 minutes. Estimate Ben has now eaten at least 1/12 of the party food. As he munches happily, I grab a magazine from the rack by the till and try to lower my blood pressure by reading my horoscope. Jupiter is now transiting your 9th house, which is truly one of the most beneficial things it can do for you. Your consciousness is lifted and your perspective grows. You find yourself imbued with loving feelings towards everyone, even children who have been impossible to control. The most positive effect of this moment is that your rage level sinks to an all-time low. The trick will be to hold on to this feeling of serenity once the euphoria wears off. Excuse me, madam. I look up, expecting that it's my turn to put items on the conveyor belt. Instead, the checkout girl informs me that I have been queuing in a regular aisle through which the Isle of Wight cannot pass.
Sorry, madam, if you could just move to one of the designated wider aisles.
Sorry? Sorry doesn't exactly cover it, does it? For 5 seconds, I go very quiet, then drive my fist into a 12-pack of hula hoops. The bang brings a security guard vaulting over the barrier. Ben bursts into tears, as does every other child in the immediate area. Am imbued with loving feelings towards everyone. 4:39 p.m. The checkout person is so slow she may as well be underwater. Even worse, she is helpful and friendly.
You know if you buy another one of those, you get one free.
Sorry?
Fromage frais. Don't you want one free?
No, I don't.
Having a party, are you?
No, I am buying 80 mini-sausages, 24 Barbie chocolate rolls, and a bumper bag of iced gems for my own consumption, because I am a deranged bulimic. My daughter, she's 6 tomorrow.
Ah, lovely. Got a reward card?
No, I...
You want one with this lot, don't you? Save yourself a bit, love.
Actually, I haven't got time to.
Cash back?
No, really, I just have to go.
Isn't she lovely?
Sorry?
Your little girl, isn't she lovely?
He's a boy.
Oh, wouldn't know it with all them curls. You want to tell your mum to get your hair cut, little man?
Why can't supermarkets designate a working mother aisle where you can be served by surly, super-efficient androids? Or French people? The French would be perfect. 9:43 p.m. Everything is under control. Both children are in bed. Pass the parcel took a mere 1 hour and 45 minutes to assemble. Deborah warned me that you're not allowed to have just one gift in the middle, like we used to have when we were little. These days, there has to be a present in each layer, in an attempt to convince kids that life is fair. Why? Life is not fair. Life is layers of wrapping with one broken squeaker in the middle. Next door, Richard is filling party bags in front of the TV. In theory, I disapprove of the escalation of gifts that kids expect to take home. Like the arms race, it can only lead to mutually assured ruination. In practice, I am too cowardly to hand over the balloon and piece of cake I feel would be more than sufficient. The mafia would take out a contract on me. Unfortunately, the supermarket was unable to swap the pink-iced birthday cake I had ordered for a yellow one at short notice. Pink used to be Emily's favourite colour, then it became yellow. When I ordered the cake, pink was once more in the ascendant, but yellow made an overnight comeback while I was away last week. Never mind, I have bought a Victoria sponge and will now ice it myself in a wobbly but loving manner. The mother's touch that means so much. Oh shit, where is the icing sugar? 11:12 p.m. I finally find the box wedged at the back of a cupboard under a weeping bottle of soy sauce. A year past its sell-by date, the icing sugar comes out of the packet in one piece. It looks a lot like one of those Apollo moon rocks my dad cooked up 30 years ago. Or £50 worth of crack cocaine. Luckily, it is not the latter, otherwise would consume entire piece by myself and lie down on kitchen floor awaiting merciful instant death. Should be just enough to cover the cake anyway. It takes 8 minutes to pound the icing rock to dust. Careful not to add too much warm water, then eke in the teeniest drop of yellow colouring. This produces a shade of pale lemon. A bit mimsy, a bit, how can I put this, a bit head boy's mother's dress at prep school speech day. Need something cheerier for a birthday. Egg yolk yellow, Van Gogh yellow. Emboldened, I add a couple of drops more. The colour is now both watery and intense, like a rank urine specimen. I add a further 2 drops and stir furiously. I am tearfully contemplating the contents of the basin when Rich comes into the kitchen, talking about some documentary on child development.
Do you know that babies identify their gender roles from 3 months? Probably why Ben spends all day sitting on the potty reading the sports pages, like father, like... Christ, Kate, What's that?
Rich has spotted the icing. The icing is now a colour which, if you were being kind, could be described as safari yellow. It is disturbingly reminiscent of one of Ben's more challenging nappies. Richard laughs, that unforgivable, liberated laugh that escapes when you're just so fantastically grateful someone else has screwed up, not you.
Don't worry, honey, he says. Let's work the problem. We have icing the colour of dung, so we will make a cowcake. Got any white chocolate buttons?
Sunday, 7:19 p.m. The party went pretty well, if you discount Joshua Mayhew throwing up in the hall, and the moment when I brought in the cake and started the singing. Happy birthday, dear Emily, happy birthday to you.
But, Mummy, I don't want brown icing, she wailed.
It's not brown, darling, it's yellow.
I don't want yellow, I want pink.
When all 18 guests have departed, I set about clearing up the debris. Juice cartons like collapsed lungs, Barbie paper plates, 26 untouched egg sandwiches. There to make the parents feel better. No self-respecting child would even nibble anything so free of additives. Earlier today, I sent an email to Jack Abelhammer suggesting that, under the circumstances, it might be better if I handed over his fund to a colleague. My feelings for him, it started as a minor crush, and now I feel as though I'm lying under a steamroller, have made our professional relationship hard to handle. The tone of my message was friendly but firm. For a couple of hours afterwards, I felt the steady glow of having acted responsibly, the brightest bulb in the maternal firmament. Since then, though, the bulb has blown. Either that or I have tripped over the lead and unplugged myself from the mains. No juice, no flow of energy, certainly no current affairs. Have already checked my inbox 5 times for his reply. Come on, Kate, grow up. Stop acting like a lovesick teenager. In my self-denial, I have so far eaten 2 chocolate Barbie rolls and a bowl of Twiglets and poured a half bottle of gin into the homemade lemonade I bought at Marks and Spencer and decanted into a pink jug to pass off as my own. It's a hot night, viscous, thirsty for rain. The fan I dug out from under the stairs is no use. It sits on the kitchen table, sluggishly stirring the soupy air. There was an attempt at thunder earlier, just as we were leaving the swimming baths around 4, but it was more like a ripping of brown paper than the full-throated roar we need to scare off the heat. Christ, the heat! And the smell! I am out in the garden scraping the rug over which Joshua Mayhew threw up. The oatmeal vomit is studded with pastel minarets of iced gems. I did notice Josh looking pale and clammy during past the parcel and managed to get him out into the hall, but as I was struggling with the front door, he deposited his birthday tea on the runner. When his mother turned up, she shrieked, "What has happened to poor little Joshy?" I managed to suppress the obvious reply. What has happened is that little Joshy has carpet-bombed £500 worth of Uzbekistan kilim. If it had been the contents of my child's stomach, I would have been down on my knees proffering a checkbook. But Imogen Mayhew, a person so wholesome her entire being seems to have been woven from chamomile, just demanded to know if Joshua had been allowed to have excess sugar. I laughed a tinkly hostess laugh and said that sugar was a traditional staple of birthday parties, but Imogen did not join in the laughter. She left with a look which suggested I can expect imminent litigation against my Nigella fairy cakes. Then, as soon as she was out of the door, I had another encounter with Angela Brunt, who was kneeling by the coats and scraping strawberry froube off Davina's green velvet. "Have you got Emily in anywhere yet, Kate?" "No." "Well, Davina has a guaranteed place at Morton's, but her second interview at Piper Place is on Thursday, and that's the one we're holding out for because it opens the door to so many other things, doesn't it?" "Yes, doesn't it?" After washing my hands to try and remove the smell of vomit, I go into the sitting room where Richard has crashed out on the sofa, a Sunday Review section tented over his face. Every time he breathes out, he inflates the breasts of Madonna, whose picture is on the cover above a feature entitled From Virgin to Blessed Mother. Perhaps I should call Madonna for a mum-to-mum chat about how to sponge vomit from a kilim. Presumably at her daughter's party she has a designated sick wrangler. How much do I hate the celebrity having-it-all mother who boasts about how fulfilled she is when you just know she has a fleet of substitute mothers doing it all for her? Rich?
Hmm?
The paper slides down onto the bridge of his nose. We have to get Emily down for Piper Place.
Why?
Because it opens so many doors.
You've been talking to Angela Brunt again.
His sigh is so big it's practically a yawn. No.
Katie, that woman's poor kid is so pressurized she's going to end up as the neighborhood crack dealer.
But she can play the oboe.
All right, the neighborhood's oboe-playing crack dealer. Your daughter knows all of Mary Poppins by heart. Give her a break, okay?
Richard spent most of Emily's swimming party in the deep end with Mathilde, mother of Laurent, who is in M's class at school. I was in the shallows, pulling 10 screaming children round on a snake made of orange tubing. On the way home in the car, Rich sighed and said,
French women do keep themselves in good nick, don't they?
He sounded exactly like his mother. Mathilde doesn't work, I said crossly.
What's that got to do with it?
After the age of 30, body maintenance is a full-time job, and I already have one of those, in case you haven't noticed. For a second, he rested his head on the steering wheel.
It wasn't a criticism of you, Kate. Not everything's a criticism of you, you know.
After the kitchen is clean, and I've crawled the length of the hall, pinching up orange Watsit dust with my thumb and forefinger. If I use the Hoover, it'll wake them. I sit down for 5 minutes to watch TV. An hour later, I'm woken by the phone. It's Barbara, my mother-in-law.
I hope you don't think I'm talking out of turn, Catherine, but Richard did sound awfully fed up when I spoke to him earlier. It's not my place to say anything, of course, but let things go in a certain department, and before you know where you are, well, the whole shop closes down.
Yes, Barbara, but it's been Emily's party and...
Anyway, Richard's father and I are coming down on Saturday to take in that marvellous show at the Royal Academy.
I realise that the pause indicates I should say something.
Oh, that's nice, Barbara. Where will you be staying?
Now, don't go to too much trouble, will you? You know Donald and me. Hot water and a clean bed and we'll be right as rain.
9:40 p.m. Upstairs, Emily is still awake, but wild-eyed with tiredness after her big day. She has shucked off both duvet and nighty as usual, and lies there on the sheet, her body casting a mother-of-pearl sheen in the darkened room. Over the past year, can it really be a whole 12 months since she turned 5, her distended baby's pot belly has disappeared. Her tummy dips now and rises towards the contours of the woman she will become. More beautiful for not knowing she is beautiful. Want to love and protect and never ever hurt her. Make silent vow to be a better mother.
Mummy?
Yes, Em?
Next birthday I will be 7. Then I will be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, 20.
That's right. But you don't want to grow up too soon, sweetheart.
I do.
She juts that chin of hers.
When you are adult, you can go to Morantic.
What's Morantic? She rolls her eyes in incredulity, my world-weary sophisticate of 6.
You know, Morantic. It's a country where adults go out to dinner and kiss.
Oh, romantic. She nods, pleased I've heard of it.
Yes, Morantic.
Who told you about Morantic?
Hannah. And anyway, you have to go with boys, only sometimes they're too naughty.
I stand here in the thick, hot dark, thinking of all the conversations we will have on this subject in the years ahead, and of the ones we won't have, because she will need to have secrets in order to grow away from me, and I will need to have secrets to keep her close. As I bend to kiss her, I say,
Morantic is a fantastic country. And you know what? When you're ready to go there, Mummy and Emily will choose some lovely dresses together and we'll pack you a bag. Perhaps seeing something sorrowful in my expression, my daughter reaches out and takes my hand in her small one. It triggers a flicker, no more, of holding my own mother's hand, its coolness, the meshing of its bones.
"You can come to Morantic too, Mummy," she says. "It's not very far."
"No, love," I say, leaning down to extinguish the Cinderella light. "Mummy's too old." To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer. Dearest Catherine, perfectly understand your reservations about our meeting again in this life, and appreciate the suggestion that your esteemed colleague, Brian somebody, might take over the handling of my business. Weirdly, I find myself unwilling to do without you, Kate. Readiness is all. Good news, however, I found this great restaurant in a parallel universe. No veal, and they can do as a corner table. How are you fixed? Love, Jack. To Jack Abelhammer, from Kate Reddy. The 12th of Never looks good for me. Can we sit by the window? K. Kisses. Out in the garden, through a night as dense and soft as cloth, I swear I can hear Jack calling to me. When I was young, I left men like I left clothes, in heaps on the floor. It seemed better that way. You see, I had figured out that it was hard for someone to leave you when you'd gone already. Emotionally, I always had my suitcase packed. A therapist, if I ever had time to consult one, would probably say it was something to do with my dad walking out on us. Besides, I took the Groucho Marx line. Why would I want to be in a relationship with anyone dumb enough to be in a relationship with me? It took Richard to show me that love could be an investment, something which could silently accrue and promised long-term returns instead of a gamble that would leave you broke and broken. Before Richard, and before children, leaving was easy. Leaving now would be nothing but grief. To the kids, Richard and I are an all-purpose love hybrid called Mum and Dad. To split that unit in half, to teach them that there are two people they must learn to love separately, I just don't feel I have the right to ask my children to do that. Men leave their children because they can. Women, in general, don't leave because they can't. A mother's life is no longer her own to leave. To be with Jack, I would have to go into exile from my homeland. To find the courage to do it, I would need to be so unhappy that staying was harder than jumping. And I'm not there yet. Must remember, debt you owe to your children, debt you owe to yourself. Figure out how to reconcile the two. Minutes of meeting to be written up. Secretary Lorraine says she's off sick, but Lorraine always sick in heatwave. Self-tan, must. Look like Morticia Adams' younger sister. Grovel to clients over completely disastrously hideous performance for May, -9% versus index of -6%. May has wiped out all hard work for previous 4 months. Great results now drowned in sea of red. Suggest to clients that performance is only temporary and I'm taking measures to address it. Think of measures to address it. Deflate bouncy castle. Confront Rod over shameful, sexist, racist treatment of Momo. Stair carpet? Book stress-busting spa day, including protein facial as recommended by Ace Vogue Beauty Woman. Wedding anniversary. When is wedding anniversary? Oh, God. Chapter 30. The Patter of Tiny Feet. Thursday, 11:29 p.m. Impending visit from the parents-in-law fills the air with apprehension, like the thunder of distant wildebeest. "Don't go to any trouble, darling," says my husband. "What have you got planned for Sunday lunch?" "Don't go to any trouble, Catherine," says Barbara, calling for the third time. So then you don't go to any trouble, and she takes one look in the fridge when they arrive, tugs on her string of pearls as though it were a rosary, and drags Donald out to the car. They return with the entire contents of Sainsbury's. "So we have a bit in for emergencies." Everything is under control this time, however. I will not be found wanting.
There are clean sheets on the guest bed and clean white towels snatched up in M&S at lunchtime. I have even put a nodding sprig of lily of the valley in a bedside vase for that graceful, womanly touch of the sort practiced by Cheryl, my uber housewife sister-in-law. Also, I must remember to dig out and display in prominent positions all Donald and Barbara's presents from down the years. Watercolour of Sunset Over Coniston by the celebrated local artist Pamela Anderson. No relation, alas. Royal Worcester Egg Coddlers, 4. Electric Wok, Dick Francis novel in hardback. Beatrice Potter, commemorative cake stand, also... There was definitely another also. Swab down the kitchen worktop, then check M's book bag ready for the morning. Inside, slotted among the pages of Lily, the lost dog, is a note from school. Could parents please contribute an example of food typical to their child's cultural background and bring it in for World Feast Day? No, parents could not. Parents are very busy earning a living, thank you, and happy for school to do the job for which it is paid. I read down to the bottom of the note. Great feast is tomorrow. All welcome. Next to this threatening injunction, Emily has inscribed in her fiercest, pressed-down writing,
My mummy is a very good cook, much better than Sophie's mum.
Oh, hell. Start to search the cupboards. What qualifies as English ethnic, for heaven's sake? Roast beef? Spotted dick? I find a jar of English mustard, but it has a disgusting rubbery collar of ancient gunge, like Mick Jagger lips, pouting around the lid. Fish and chips? Good, but no fish, and never made chips in my life. Could take in McDonald's large fries wrapped in newspaper, but just imagine the faces of the whole food Nazis led by Mother Alexandra Law. At the back of the cereal shelf, I discover two jars of Bon Maman jam. Strawberry preserve is an excellent example of the indigenous culinary arts, except this stuff is made in France. Brilliant idea. Boil the kettle. Picking up one jar and then the other, I hold them over the steam till the label wilts and slips off. In the freezer bag drawer, I find some new labels, and on them I write, in rounded bucolic lettering, Shattuck Strawberry Jam. Overconfident now, I attempt to draw a luscious strawberry in the corner of the label. It looks like an inflamed pancreas. Glue labels onto jars, et voila! Je suis une bonne maman. Kate, what are you doing? It's gone midnight. Rich has come into the kitchen in boxers and T-shirt, carrying a Furby. I detest the Furby. The Furby is a hideous cross between a chinchilla and Bette Davis in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Both Furby and husband squint dubiously at me through the half-light. I'm making jam. Actually, I'm remaking jam, if you must know. Emily's school is having this ethnic feast tomorrow, and she has to take in something English.
Couldn't you just buy something in the morning?
No, Rich, I couldn't. His sigh is almost a shout. God, how many times do we have to go through this? I've told you, you have to learn to let go. When women are working as hard as you are, Kate, other people are just going to have to accept that you can't do all the stuff your mothers did. I want to tell him that even if other people accept it, I'm not sure I ever will. But the Furby gets there before me, breaking the silence with a crooning chirrup, and Rich disappears upstairs. 12:39 a.m. Too tired for sleep. I put the Furby in a black bin bag and tie a knot in the neck. In the dark kitchen, I open my laptop and sit here bathed in its milky metallic light. I call up the Salinger file. The figures on screen comfort me, the way they do my bidding so readily, the fact that I cannot lie to them. Whereas at home, I'm a forger, a faker. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't see any alternative. A good mum makes her own jam, doesn't she? Secretly, we all know that. When they start naming preserves jet lag maman or quality time mum, when bread comes in wrappers marked father's pride, it will be safe for us bad, exhausted mothers to come out with our hands up. Friday, 7:10 a.m. Richard raised his voice. I've never known him to raise his voice before, only to ask me to lower mine. But there we were sitting in the kitchen at breakfast with the kids jabbering away, and you should have heard him bite Emily's head off.
Mummy, can I have a baby sister?
No, darling.
But I want one. Daddy, can we have a baby sister?
No, you cannot.
Why?
Because to make a baby sister, mummies and daddies have to have time together in the same room.
Rich is watching the TV with the volume turned down, his eyes glued to the crescent pout of Chloe Zoe. Don't, Richard.
And your mummy and daddy never have time, Emily. Mummy is just about to go to New York again, so under those circumstances it will be particularly hard to make a baby sister. Or maybe mummy would like me to get a man in for her. Isn't that what mummy always asks daddy to do when the lights go out? Get a man in?
I said don't.
Why not, Kate? Never lie to her. Isn't that what you said?
Mum, Daisy's got a baby sister.
And you've got a baby brother, Em.
But he's a boy.
8:52 a.m. For once, I drop Emily off at school myself. I called work and said I had to see the doctor. In the hierarchy of excuses, poor health is better than a needy small girl. Em is thrilled to have me there with the other mummies. She parades me before her friends like a show horse, patting my rump and pointing out my good features.
My mummy's lovely and tall, isn't she?
I was hoping to slip in my World Feast contribution unnoticed, but there is a table bang in the middle of the school hall, groaning with ethnic offerings. One mother appears to have brought along an entire curried goat. Kirsty's mum has done haggis, clad in genuine stomach. Christ! Quickly hide my strawberry jam behind a crenellated fortress of soda bread.
Kate, hello! Have you gone part-time yet?
Booms Alexandra Hall, unveiling a trifle the size of an inverted Albert Hall.
No, I'm afraid where I work they don't really do part-time. To be honest, they think full-time is skiving.
The other mothers laugh, all except Claire Dalton, a senior partner at Sheridan and Farquhar. Claire, I notice, is trying to sneak a small bowl of green jelly onto the World Feast altar. She is holding the jelly very still, so as not to give away the fact that it is unset. 12:46 p.m. Candy is keeping the baby. She refuses to talk about it, but her belly has made her intentions increasingly clear. The Stratton wardrobe, always on the challenging side of Slinky, is now straining to contain her. So today I have brought in a bag of maternity clothes, one or two nice pieces she can wear for work, and a couple of useful sacks for later on. I hand the bag to her without comment over lunch in Pizza Navona. She lifts out a taupe shift dress and holds it up incredulously.
Hey, brown paper packages tied up with string. These are a few of my favorite things.
I thought they might come in useful, that's all.
What for?
For your pregnancy.
Jesus Christ, what's this?
Candy takes out a white broderie Anglaise nighty and flaps it like a flag to the amusement of the group of guys at the next table.
I surrender, she pleads.
Look, it has an easy opening for feeding.
Why would I want to eat anything wearing a... Oh, God, you mean someone feeding off me. That's so disgusting.
Yes, well... It's been pretty common practice for the past 150,000 years.
Not in New Jersey, it hasn't.
Kate?
Yes?
It's not gonna be needy, is it? I study Candy's face closely.
She's not joking.
No, it won't be needy, I promise.
Not after the first 18 years, I should add. But for my friend's sake, I hold my tongue. She isn't ready yet.
3:19 p.m. A state of emergency. Rue is missing. Paula calls and says she knows for definite that he was in the buggy when she took Ben to Little Star's music group this morning, and she's pretty sure Rue came back with them. But then, when she went to put Ben down for his afternoon nap, they couldn't find him. Ben was devastated. Screamed and screamed for his toy, while Paula searched the house. High and low, but there was no kangaroo to be seen. I can hear Ben hiccuping with grief in the background. What was she doing taking Rue out of the house in the first place? I can't believe Paula could be so stupid when she knows how awful it would be if he got lost. I voice this thought out loud, and instead of snapping back, she just sounds culpable and sad.
Do you think we can find another one, Kate?
I've no idea what the market in used kangaroos is like, Paula. 3:29 p.m. Call Woolworths, where Rue came from originally. Assistant says sorry, but she believes they are out of kangaroos. Would I like to speak to the manager? Yes. Manager says that kangaroos have been discontinued.
There's been a big trend away from the softer animals towards plastic novelty creatures, Mrs. Reddy. Would you perhaps be interested in a Mr. Potato Head?
No. I already work with a dozen of those. 3:51 p.m. Try Harrods. Surely they must have a Rue. They have everything, don't they? A woman in the toy department says she may have something. She'll just go and check in the next room if I can hang on. When she gets back, she describes something, but it sounds all wrong.
No, I can't have one with a baby.
It's an emergency.
Australian, yes. I need one about 8 inches long for tonight.
Kate, I didn't know you cared.
I look up to see Rod Task leering down at me.
Oh, God.
Sorry, Rod. I'm just looking for a kangaroo.
Great. I never thought you'd ask.
There is a nasty snicker from Guy 2 desks away. When Rod is out of earshot, I tell him to get onto the internet and start researching toy marsupials right away. 9:43 p.m. It takes 2 hours and 43 minutes to persuade my son to go to sleep. All the substitute comforters I offer, lamb, polar bear, purple dinosaur, each of the Teletubbies in rotation, are hurled in a fury out of the cot.
Ooh,
he wails.
Ooh.
To get him to settle, I have to let him hold my electric toothbrush, and then we sit in the blue chair with him sprawled over me, clutching my shirt like a baby monkey. At the bottom of each boy breath, there is a sticky catch, like a tiny gate being opened in his lungs. Please, God, let me find another Rue. Everything was going well during Barbara and Donald's visit. Suspiciously well, I see that now. To the best of her ability, Barbara had complimented me on the kitchen.
I'm sure it will be lovely when it's finished, she said.
But I smiled graciously throughout, even during tea with the children, when Barbara turned to Donald and said,
Isn't it funny? Emily looks like Richard when she smiles, and Kate when she frowns.
For dinner that night, we were having Italian. I had washed and dried a pile of arugula. The red peppers had been charred and then peeled with the same lavish care I used to bring to a scab on the knee in infant school. At the top of the oven, there was a leg of lamb, and at the bottom, the potatoes, suffused with rosemary from my very own garden, were hunkering down nicely. I had even squeezed in a bath after the kids' bedtime and put on a clean blouse and velvet skirt, over which I wore the wipeable Liberty print apron the in-laws gave me for Christmas. Yes, I thought, surveying the scene at dinner. This is one of those rare times when life approaches the condition of Colour magazine. The domestic goddess entertaining her admiring parents-in-law in her lovely, stylish home. Barbara had just asked me for the peppers recipe, and then I saw it. Moving across the oak floor, the plump, suede rear of a rat. Etiquette books are unnaturally silent on the subject of rats at dinner parties. Do you A. laugh gaily and pretend the rat is a treasured pet? B. exclaim, Ah, there's the main course. Nigel Slater says rodent's the coming thing. Very good done the Vietnamese way, apparently. C. invite your guests to adjourn upstairs. Ply them with as much drink as possible and put on a Burt Bacharach CD to drown out the sound from the kitchen where your husband is pursuing the rodent with your daughter's Mary Poppins umbrella. Richard and I went for C. Downstairs, the rat holed up in the baby's playpen, perhaps hoping to pass for a soft toy. Before long, though, it was doing frisky circuits of the kitchen.
Barbara said that, come to think of it, she remembered feeling something running across her feet. She would need to take some aspirin immediately and go and lie down. Nobody was in the mood for my amaretto peaches in raspberry coulis. I suddenly had a very bad feeling about the clumps of raisins that had been appearing on the kitchen floor.
"Don't get hysterical," said Richard, after he had got the rat out of the patio door and into the garden. "Remember, they're more afraid of you than you are of them."
This seemed unlikely. The rat triggered what I can only call rat dread. That back flip of the stomach every time you open a cupboard, not knowing whether you will come face to face with a face. That night, whiskers and paws scurried through my dreams. Monday, 9:38 a.m. I have been fired by my own cleaner. In the annals of domestic humiliation, how high does that rate? When I came down this morning, I found Barbara and Juanita in an accusing huddle. My mother-in-law was tutting audibly as my cleaner mimed a rat scurrying along the worktop and pointed to parts of the kitchen made impassable by newspapers and toys.
"It's no wonder," said Barbara.
Although my mother-in-law is not a Spanish speaker, she was able to communicate with Juanita in the international female language of disapproval. "The rat man is on his way," I announced loudly, to alert them to my presence and to stop the exchange of further examples of my sluttishness. At the sound of the pest's name, Juanita unleashed a machine-gun burst of woe. "If you leave food out, it will attract vermin," volunteered Barbara. "I do not leave food out," I said, but she was already in the hallway where Donald was assembling the luggage. He gave me a rueful little wave. When they had gone, Juanita told me she was very sorry, but she couldn't take it any more. This all communicated via operatic arm gestures and sobs. Here at long last was my chance to point out that one of the reasons the house was in such a mess was because my cleaner had been unable to clean it for the past 2 years, owing to a succession of ailments which I had reacted to with enormous sympathy because, oh, probably because I am from a background where you don't expect to have anyone else tidying up after you, and some sneaking shame is attached to the fact that you're a woman who can't keep her own house clean. "Kate may be a whiz with figures," Cheryl, my sister-in-law, once said, "but you should see the state of her skirting boards." So did I give Juanita a piece of my mind there and then? Not exactly. I gave her all the cash I had in my purse, promised to send more in the post, and said I would recommend her to some friends in Highgate who were looking for a cleaner. Must remember. Chase Ratman again. Hire new cleaner. Replacement rue must. Proxy voting policy to be agreed with clients. Complete quarterly performance questionnaire. Meeting minutes due myself. Secretary Lorraine still off sick in heatwave. Prospect for gaining client in final just done with Momo, blown by bloody awful June performance. Check competitors' performance, perhaps theirs even worse. Conference call with Japanese office to discuss stocks. Sandals for Emily, or will be questioned by NSPCC over foot cruelty. Sugar puffs, Panadol extra, cancel spa day. Chapter 31. Nanny Crisis. 6:27 a.m. It's still very early, but sitting out here in the garden, I can tell it's going to be a hot day. The air is glassy with the promise of heat. When I was away in the States, no one took care of the plants, so the snails have hoovered up my hosta, and the pansies in the terracotta pots are practically desiccated. If you touch one, it turns to purple ash. I planted that kind especially, too. It's called heartsease. One day, when I have time, the garden will be beautiful. I am going to grow lobelias and camellias and bay and jasmine, and there will be carved stone troughs overflowing with heartsease. I hear a yelp escape from a window high up in the house. Like me, the children are finding it hard to sleep these warm nights. Ben already woke screaming around 5 when I was in the middle of some awful dream. You even dream differently in summer. Fevered, tentacular dreams that pull you down towards thoughts you'd rather stayed buried.
Anyway, when I went into his room, he was slithery with sweat, poor baby. Slid through my arms like a seal pup. Took him into the bathroom, sponged him down. He's suddenly afraid of his piglet flannel for some reason. Then changed him. Offered him a beaker of water, and he was furious.
Apple,
he demanded.
Apple!
How many times have I told Paula that he's not allowed juice? In my mind, composed a major nanny bollocking, but Paula has been complaining of women's trouble lately, so could easily pull a sickie, and the holidays are the worst possible time to find cover. Damn, damn. 7:32 a.m. I could tell right away from Paula's voice that she wasn't coming in. And me chairing the Global Asset Allocation Committee today, because Robin Cooper Clark's away with his boys, and Emily and Ben with no school or nursery to occupy them, and the nanny's not coming in. Great. Traditionally a period of pleasure and relaxation, the summer holidays are the very worst time of the year for a working mother. Warm weather and careless days act as a constant rebuke. There are outings you wish you could join, cool paddling pools you would like to slip off your shoes and step into, ice cream cones whose vanilla tributaries you would be more than happy to lick. Paula exhales a long, complicated sigh. Says she's not been feeling that well for a while, and the rat thing, of course, has been very upsetting. But she didn't want to worry me, because I know you're busy, Kate. A classic nanny tactic, this. Landing a preemptive strike before your own more powerful grievance has a chance to leave the ground. Even as I murmur mms of sympathy, I am riffling through my mental Rolodex, searching for someone who can take the children just for today. Richard is away, presenting plans for a Sunderland craftsyurt. First thought, Angela Brunt, my neighbour and leader of local mafia. I start dialing her number, but suddenly picture Angela's Ford Anglia face, headlamps on full gleam, when it becomes clear that the high flyer across the road is emerging from the burning fuselage of her own selfishness to beg for help. No, can't possibly give her the satisfaction. Instead, I call Alice, my TV producer friend, and ask a favour. Could her nanny Jo possibly have Emily and Ben? I wouldn't ask, only I have this big meeting, and taking time off from EMF is practically illegal, and... Alice cuts me off with a raucous, I've been there yelp. Says it's fine as long as I have no objections to Jo taking the kids swimming with her boys. At this point, I have no objection to Ben and Emily going parasending in Borneo, so long as I can get into the city and start preparing for my meeting. 7:43 a.m. Call Pegasus. Winston answers the phone. Why? Doesn't Pegasus have any other drivers? I'm starting to wonder what kind of racket he's running. Winston says he'll be 15 minutes. I tell him I need him in 4.
See what I can do, he says coolly.
I have a sudden and impossible longing to climb into the lap of a large, comforting person and be held there for, 25 years should probably do the trick.
Mummy?
What is it, Em?
Heaven's a nice place, isn't it?
Yes, heaven's a very nice place.
Is there a McDonald's?
Where?
In heaven.
God, no. I need to pack Ben's wings.
For heaven?
What? No, water wings. You're going swimming. You remember Nat and Jacob, don't you?
Why doesn't heaven have McDonald's, Mum?
Because I've no idea. Because dead people don't need to eat anything.
Why don't dead people eat anything?
Ben, no. No, Benjamin. Sit down. Mummy will fetch you that juice in a... Not on my dress!
Mummy, can I have my next birthday party in heaven?
Emily, will you please be quiet? 7:44 a.m. Winston has pulled up outside the house in a new chariot, new to him, practically fossilized to the rest of us. The Nissan Primera is hidden behind a cloud of its own dirt, but at least when you open the door it doesn't rain dust on your clothes. I load the children into the back, clasp Ben on my knee, and with the free hand call a nanny agency on the mobile. A Sloaney girl, her voice designed to carry across stag-rich moors, said she would really like to help, but it's a particularly bad time for temps.
It's the school holidays, you know.
Yes, I know. Everyone's been snapped up ages ago. Only she does have this new girl on the books. Croatian. 18. English not her best thing, but really keen. Likes children.
Well, that's a start.
Rack brain trying to remember which side Croatia was on in Balkan massacres. Think they sided with the Nazis in the war, and they are the good guys now. Maybe it's the other way around. I say, okay, I'll interview her tonight. What's her name?
Ratka.
Of course it is. Must remember to call Ratman. Why didn't he show up? Emily pats my leg urgently. She has been in deep conversation with our driver.
Mummy, Winston says the nice thing about being in heaven is if you're hungry, you can lean over and bite off a bit of cloud. Like candy floss, the angels make it.
She looks far happier with this explanation than any I have managed to come up with. Alice lives in a gentrified house on the edge of Queen's Park. She bought in the area before a four-bedroom terraced cost more than Colorado. Once inside, my daughter wanders off happily to play with Nat and Jake, but Ben takes one look at the unfamiliar Brio set and clings to my right leg like a sailor lashing himself to the mast in a Force 10. I need to get out of here fast, but I have to spend a few minutes humbling myself before Jo, the nanny. Can see her eyeing the hysterical toddler and wondering what she's got herself into. I end up having to shake him off me and run out of the room with his screams at my back. Sitting in the back of Pegasus, I try to read the Financial Times to bring myself up to speed for the meeting, but I can't concentrate. Shake head fiercely to dislodge memory of Ben's tears. I can see Winston studying me in the rearview mirror. We are at the Old Street roundabout before he finally speaks.
How much they paying you, lady?
None of your business.
50? 100?
Depends on my bonus, but this year there isn't going to be any bonus. After June's performance, be lucky to keep my job, frankly. Winston bangs the sheepskin steering wheel with both hands.
You gotta be kidding. They got you every second of every minute of every day. You their slave girl.
I can't do very much about it, Winston. I'm what's technically known as the main breadwinner.
Whoa!
He stamps on the brake to avoid a nun on a zebra crossing.
How your man feel about that? Kind of thing tend to make the guys feel a little small in the Johnson department.
Are you seriously suggesting that the size of my salary is shrinking my husband's penis?
Well, it would account for why no one out there can't make no babies no more, wouldn't it? Fertility rate was doing just fine till women went out to work.
I think you'll find that's down to estrogen in the water.
I think you'll find that's down to estrogen in the office.
Even from the back seat, I can tell he is grinning broadly, because his cheeks are stretched so taut they have rumpled up the skin under his ears.
For God's sake, Winston, this is the end of the 20th century.
He shakes his head, and a sprinkling of gold dust fills the cab. Like a fairy godmother, Emily said when she saw it.
Don't matter what century it is, he growls. The clock in men's head always set to the same time. Pussy time.
I thought we'd all grown up and got over that caveman nonsense.
That's where people like you got it all wrong, lady. The women, they outgrew it, and the guys, they just went along so they could keep getting the women to have sex with them. The guy, he just asked himself, what tune she want me to play now? And he play it. Here, try one of these.
Winston chucks a tin at me. I recognize the round bronze container from childhood. Travel sweets. Julie and I preferred the frosted pears, the ones that tasted the way bells would taste if you licked bells. But we always got given these, barley sugar.